Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Hello, everybody. Welcome to That Blog Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Head. Today's podcast is brought to you in part by BetterHelp.com. Get affordable private online counseling anytime, anywhere. Talk with a licensed professional therapist online, and you can get your 7-day trial with the code word Apolog by going to BetterHelp.com/Apolog. It's, people need help. And this is the best way to do it. It's affordable, it's private, it's online. These are all, these hit great bullet points. Bullet points is a thing that corporate people use. Bullet point. I'd like to thank everybody for shopping on Amazon. I see that there's a bit of a rush in there, and that's great to see. You can help the show out too by going, if it costs you no extra money, by going to apolog.ca/Amazon or apolog.ca/USAmazon. You can go to the old-fashioned way by going to apolog.ca and click on those banners located on the right side. Locate your country, the Canada, the United States, the UK. Bookmark those links, and every time you shop on Amazon, use those links to shop and support the show. It costs you no extra money. It's true. It costs you no money. If you're thinking about doing it, just go to type in this URL. If you're going to go on Amazon, everybody does it. Amazon is, go to apolog.ca/Amazon. Boom, you're there. It's a little work. I'd like to thank all the patrons I have, and you can become a patron too by going to patreon.com/apolog. Pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees, and you can cancel at any time. You can go to the apolog.ca/shop and buy a t-shirt and buy some music there. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show. Give it 5 stars, please. It always helps out. Every show is there. You're going to get every show except for episode one. Episode one was a piss fest, and I didn't want to put it up because we were talking crap about everybody. So it's not going up. Like the show on Facebook. Hey, how about this? If you go to Patreon and pledge $10 a month for 6 months, I'll give you episode one. How about that? All right? Do that. There's some incentive. Like I said, like the show on Facebook by going to facebook.com/apologpod. Follow me on Twitter at SimonHead666. Today on the show, I have Mr. John Hebert. He is a guitar player. He has been in the punk rock scene in Calgary and in Canada for well over 30 years. He had a band that, when I played in a band called Red Fisher, he had a band called Field Day. But he's been in all so many bands before then. He's like I said, a staple point in the punk rock scene, if in Calgary, if not the Canada's. He's a great guy. His name's John Hebert. And I don't know why I've known him for 25 years and I kept saying his last name wrong. But here he is, John Hebert on the Apolog Podcast. Good to see you. It's been a very, very long time. I can't remember the last time we actually even spoke.
I think I do remember, as I think you were the technical director at a place in Mississauga or something. I was coming through as a stage manager and LD for a kids show.
Oh.
Remember, like the Backyardigans or something like that?
Oh. Now, was that the Living Arts Center?
Living Arts Center.
Yeah, yeah, I think I was just the sound guy in that.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the last time. That's the last time I talked to you.
You're on tour with the Backyardigans.
Well, something like, yeah, or Franklin the Turtle, or.
Yeah. So, my gosh, it's been you've been playing music and been involved with music for far longer than me. When did you first start playing in bands?
When I was 15, my brother and I started a band called RSG, which was a rip, shred, and grind. And yeah, it was Skateboarder magazine. We had listened to Queen and CCR, but then we stumbled across Elvis Costello and Devo, mm-hmm. and then the Buzzcocks. And that was kind of it sent us off running, but we couldn't really play very well too. So at that point, my brother and I, we just wanted to play, but it was a struggle for us because we were kids that weren't really applied to what we wanted to do. We were all over the place. We wanted to skateboard. We were doing petty crimes like garden raiding and stuff like that too. So
what years was this? 77, 78, 70?
No, it's been 79.
Yeah.
80, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, that would have been just sort of like the end of sort of dirty punk and sort of getting into sort of almost new wave. I guess new wave was actually 80 would have been sort of new wave-ish. And then from there, it turned it went all over the place.
Yeah, and that's where it did start too. Blondie was in there too.
Yeah.
I think that, again, I'll go back to Skateboarder Magazine and just having the skateboard community. We were looking outside of what we were listening to on the radio, which, you know, I enjoyed Meatloaf. God, I love Meatloaf and those melodies, right? But it's, there was something about, what was being given to us, out of the blue in this magazine that we were kind of, you know, we were skateboarders. So, sorry, I'm going a little off, but,
totally good. Yeah.
Yeah. It was really startling at the time too, because it was something that almost made sense.
Yeah,
and that you know, I'd always kind of felt marginalized and a little awkward, and all of a sudden this unpolished music that came around and said that you know it's okay to feel awkward and not perfect. And not have to. I know. Can you see him?
I wish that we could show this on the podcast. Your cat is attacking you. It's so amazing.
I bet.
Well, did you grow? Were you always from Calgary area? Like what part of Alberta? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I always grew up in South Calgary.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the scene then was mostly like, what was it, like top 40 rock radio, or it must have been the beginnings of punk rock and sort of how it all migrated. In all directions.
Yeah, well, there was the kind of our peers. There's a few people older than us, like Ron Hadley and Laurie Anderson, and the Manor crew, which was the Manor is a big house that was in the Social Distortion movie. And it was those. I know he keeps coming up. It was the older folks that started just putting on shows at this place called Hillhurst Community Center. And my first show was The Verdicts, The Breeders, Silicone Injections. And that, like the second show was DOA. And that would have been 1980.
Yeah. So were you, always sort of like a young band that sort of, it's sort of ahead of everybody. Was that sort of your band, or were your early band was sort of like, hey, these kids can play, or was it just the fact like a novelty thing, like being young and opening up for larger bands? Or did you guys make a big effort to try to get opening slots with bands like DOA?
No, we were basically unfocused and just were into the experience of it.
Mm-hmm. It just all happened.
Yeah. Of just going to the Calgarian. It was actually Personality Crisis was probably one of the biggest influences of the guys and girls that I knew that were kind of around my age and starting bands and being into stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The way that their live show was and how proficient they were at what they were doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like 15 years old and to see Mitch Funk towering over you and those guys ripping, like you cannot believe. To see John Card and those guys at that time, like, yeah, that just set me off.
Yeah, it's I mean, Calgary in the day was, you know, obviously to be disenfranchised in Calgary is a lot like being disenfranchised in Toronto or in Vancouver or wherever. There's still some type of, you need an outlet to sort of, and a community. And that's sort of what I think created a little bit stronger in like the prairies is that there was a seemed to be a stronger punk rock community in general. I don't know. I think you could probably have some perspective on it, but like, what do you think, like based on larger cities and stuff like that at the time?
Well, I didn't really know too much of the larger cities as far as the punk rock scene, as far as just going to Vancouver, mm-hmm. like at that time in the early 80s. I really think that there was some influential people that were having that had venues that would put stuff like that on at the time. The Calgarian, the Royal Albert, the Spartans Hall in Edmonton. Yeah. There was, it was tough at that time. And as you know, I know that you're a little younger than me, but you know, it was still tough at that time or any time to rent a hall for a punk rock show.
Yeah.
But yeah. Then, you know, Gubby, that was involved in BYO, mm-hmm. kind of united Vancouver and Winnipeg and hooked up with BYO in California.
Yeah.
And it started, you know, I think there was, you know, for better or worse, there was a collective and a youth movement mm-hmm. to put on shows. Don't screw it up. Share phone numbers. You know, and that was before the internet and before, you know, we would share phone numbers, right? Here's and at times illegally go, here's a credit card number. So if you want to book, if you want to, you know, use it to book some of your shows until it dies, here it is. So.
Yeah, or phone cards too. It's like the Bell phone cards. I remember getting a few of those and booking shows on from the payphone, like down the road when I lived in Winnipeg, like. You didn't see how many times it would work, and it would only work in Canada. And then the other scam was we had a friend who worked at a hotel, and you called the 1-800 number until he answered, and then he would patch you through to other people. Like, you'd give him phone numbers, and he would call mm-hmm. all the venues throughout North America for nothing. That was a John Stewart scam. Yeah. Like, he had that thing going. It was so strong and good.
Yeah.
You know, and that sort of punk rock was a way of sort of like get one over and sort of getting something out of it. And that was, I love those days. I mean, like as you get older, those are the times you kind of miss and kind of find romantic, but highly illegal. Like, it really screw up your whole life if they get caught. Yeah. With fraud.
And you're fucking somebody else over. So, you know, as much as I still like to push the boundaries, I don't screw anyone over anymore. Yeah. And I don't really, I pay it on my own dime, but I do like those times. And when you, when we first talked about getting together to do this, I just kind of wanted to talk to you, but mm-hmm. I had questions about Red Fisher too, because we had some good times together. But
absolutely.
I was always curious as to why, if I can turn this on you, Red Fisher and, how did it never come to fruition that there was a full-length album, or how did, because I knew all three of you guys just kind of intensely at times, but then we would just go away, so we didn't, you know, I was always curious as to, because Red Fisher was, you know, it was a great band. So what happened?
well see, there was a time in the early 90s before I had joined the band where they were getting sort of like, it was sort of the new era of like punk rock was becoming commercialized, and apparently there was labels scouting the band before I had joined. I had no idea of this. And I moved from Toronto to, I left Trigger Happy to go join Red Fisher, a Toronto band. And what my observation was, as a guy from Toronto who was full of piss and vinegar, that the West Coast side of keep it mellow and let's not try to overexpose or any of this stuff, that sort of fell short on the whole idea that I was ambitious. Like, I wanted to, you know, make this into the biggest band in the world. And I knew that John and Jason were just sort of like, well, we like it, it's fun. You know what I mean? So the enthusiasm, they had already been a band for 6 years at that time, by the time I joined the band.
So
to me, the fire with them was, in my opinion, like, you know, and I think John might have a different opinion and Jason.
Fair enough.
You know, but my opinion is that this was something to do when they weren't doing something else, you know? So it was like a, it wasn't as, in, you know, as driving forward as I thought it would be. Although we managed to get like a government grant from the province of Manitoba to make a record. We did do a full-length record, came out on G7, but it just didn't, I don't know, it just didn't, we were great live, and I knew we had a good plan, and we were, ethically, we were pretty sound with our morals and whatnot, but yeah, I just figured that there was just something else to do than be in a band, and that's, to me, the Red Fisher story in a nutshell, you know, like, why try? It's not going to work out, you know, that seemed to be the underlying tone to everything.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing that, because yeah, and there's a lot of bands that, well, I guess a lot of musicians that, especially on a really low end DIY level, mm-hmm. as you have to always judge that line between career and how much of it your life it's going to take.
Yeah.
To do this,
yeah,
and how much you're sacrificing, and
yeah, when you're 21 years old, because I was 21 when I joined Red Fisher, I still had like that 15-year-old in me going like, "Let's just go, come on, guys, let's go on tour, let's put a record out, let's sleep on floors and punk rock.
It's gonna be awesome.
It's gonna be, it's gonna be awesome. Yeah, it's full on unabated enthusiasm and just complete utter excitement to be on tour in what
and
I
ambition
thought.
Yeah. and for to just interject, for me almost a blind ambition, because you know I didn't deal with the business or whatever, but sorry, go ahead.
No just, yeah, that's yeah. To me, I was like, I had such great, you know, when you're lying in bed, you're like, God, this is going to be great. Like, this band was, as a three-piece, I'm sure you'd know, being in a three-piece yourself, like, it's tremendously rewarding to make a full sounding live show with just three people, and we gelled really well to begin with, and I personality wise Jason and I never really got along for like at least a couple of months after we started understanding that, you know, the common, we had, you know, a common respect, but Jason, yeah. Jason was just like a hard person to talk to and very quiet, and he never drove the van, and it was always John and I driving, and then when we were on tour. So, and then John was always out to, he'd bring his bike. So he would just jump on his bike and go find a dirt jump somewhere and go hang out. And it was sort of like just an odd dynamic for me to be on tour.
I was going to say, that's a kind of contrasting personalities, and maybe not negatively, but still that's, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a dichotomy there for sure.
Totally. I mean, like for me, I'd still wanted a family. You know what I mean? I'd moved from Toronto to be in a band. And so I thought that would be my new family, you know, my new brothers, you know, but it wasn't really like that. And I don't find, I met some really cool people when I moved to Winnipeg. And then, you know, I think we had met during the Trigger Happy days very briefly when I was coming through. We were coming through with Down by Law or something like that with Trigger Happy.
I think we might have played those shows.
Yeah.
Was it the 90s? Because Field Day did Western Canadian shows with Down by Law at some point. It's funny because I left my Flying V that I was playing with Field Day at the time in Regina, and then Dave Smalley shows up in Calgary and goes, "Hey, did you lose something?" Oh, I just was like, oh.
"Yeah, yeah." Well, we played Down by Law's first tour on that first record, Trigger Happy, from Portland to Winnipeg, and we played at the Westward Inn. That was our first real tour, actually the first tour I ever really on.
Oh, wow.
Like 1990, 91, around then.
So,
but yeah, Red Fisher and Field Day, we played some great shows in Montreal together too. Like, it was one or two Montreal shows that I thought was kind of fun and interesting.
That really show, it was called The Purple Haze.
Yeah.
It was like 40 degrees up in the place.
Yeah.
I remember that show.
And then,
the best show is at the Moon Room in Oshawa, Ontario. And there was a fight afterwards. And so, do you remember Gary from Lame?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm really good friends with Gary still. Yeah.
Yeah, Gary's great.
Yeah.
I wish he would give up some of his guitars, but I've asked him, he won't. But no, we played with Red Fisher and Lame at the Moon Room. And there was a dance club next door.
Yep.
So after that, a fight broke out outside, and I was like, and these kind of jocks were just beating up some of these punks, and the RCMP show up, and I go, okay, that guy, and that guy.
Yeah.
like they're beating these guys up and the cops are not paying any attention to me. And all of a sudden these guys are going, who the fuck is this guy ratting us out? And so I kind of have to run away. I go around the other side of the venue and they're converging on either side. And the drummer for Lame comes and with the door opens as he's driving by. I jump in as these two groups are converging on me to fucking get me for fucking ratting them out to the cops.
They got together, like they stopped fighting each other. And we're like, wait a minute, there's a common enemy here.
Exactly. We gotta get this guy. So anyway, I go back. This is a long story, but this is Gary Bergner. Jay and Jonas were in the dance club and they were involved in a fight too. And they at the same time. So we all end up at Gary from Lame's place.
That loft.
And I go, drummer came by and rescued me at the last minute. Like, wow, we got in a total fight and had to get out of there at the last minute too. We're like, wow, Oshawa. Yeah. Way to rock and roll. Holy smokes.
Oh yeah. You know that place, ironically now, is a men's shelter.
Wow.
That whole place, yeah. That was like, yeah, there was an all ages venue called the Eclipse, and then there was the Moon Room, which was the bar. And
okay, so yeah, I had it mixed up.
Yeah, but I think that was such a neat place. I actually used to work there. I was a sound guy there for a while. And
we have video of you dancing around in a Lucero mask. What is it called?
Like the wrestling mask?
Yeah, yeah. Of you dancing around while we're playing around. Yeah.
So. Oh yeah. When was that though? When would that have been? That would have been
96.
96? 95? 95? Yeah. It would have been before 95 actually. Cause I wasn't in Red Fisher after 95. Cause I ended up going to work for SNFU as a sound guy at that point. I was kind of in Red Fisher, but I kind of got the boot because I moved home. Because I'm like, I am not spending one more winter in Winnipeg. I'm sorry. And they kind of went, done? Yeah, I'm done. One winter is enough, you know, where you travel.
But it's got such an awesome scene, Simon. Like, yeah. What's your problem?
I was so cold and I caught the flu so bad. And I lived in a house with four other dudes. And not one of those people came up and said, hey, man, you all right? You okay? You feeling all right? No, are you dying?
You just deal. When you live there, you just deal. No one says, are you all right? You just get your head down. You just get your head down. You go,
ugh. And like, I mean, I didn't come out of my room for like 3 days. And they're like, hey, man, where you been? I'm like, I have stubble on my face because I hadn't left my house. Like, I hadn't left my room. And my girlfriend at the time came by and brought me soup. Like on the third day, and I started feeling better. But I came
on
out
on the third day. She brought me soup.
She did. She's like, "How come you haven't called me?" I'm like, "I've been sick." I'm like, "Nobody's taking care of me." I'm from Toronto. Such a sick little boy from Toronto. Yeah, yeah. No. But
all right, but Winnipeg was really quite a for a lot of us out in Calgary, and I'll speak for myself, is that. Whenever we went out there, it had such a, because Calgary is somewhat of a superficial town at times, lots of money, and I'm throwing generalizations, but going to Winnipeg, it was always such a, the music scene was always so supported and hardcore, and hardcore in the sense of like that it was real and, almost to the point, if there's any superficiality, it was scrutinized.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
yeah,
it was kind of refreshing to go out there and just to go like, oh fuck, like there's no stampede here. There's no guy, people in cowboy hats.
Well,
pretending for 10 days, and that's coming up. So
yeah. Well, I remember, you know,
happy stampede.
I moved. Well, actually, my parents' cousins are coming out there to the Calgary Stampede. They're from Britain. They're going to come there for the first time. I think they can ride horses when they get there, but I don't think that can happen anymore.
Well, it is, you know, let it be a good experience for them.
Totally. Well, yeah, the thing about Winnipeg, like being the young, ambitious kid moving out from Toronto, is that I learned very fast. One thing I'm good at is kind of trying to fit in. You know what I mean? So when I came in with all this sort of like, yeah, this is amazing, I really realized, like, after meeting like guys like Chris Hanna and Todd when he was in iSpy, that there was sort of like a definite like grassroots. If you would be like, you might as well be in Van Halen. You know what I mean? Like if you were, if you start talking about rock and roll or talk about making it or putting records out, it was like, okay, all right. So this is a little bit downtrodden, but at the same time, you're right. Very real for a scene. Yeah.
Yeah. I just saw Propaganda at the Palace, and I don't, there are songs that I love and that's, really, it's if I'm having a tough day, then I will put on the first song of Potemkin City Limits and make dinner, and then I'm back.
Yeah.
So I don't listen to the whole gamut of their music, but their execution, I was trying to explain to my girlfriend Tasha, their execution, their conviction, and also their sarcasm. There's humor to it. I said that they are the top of that game of, if you are a shredding punk rock band and bringing everything, right? There's nothing left on the table.
Yeah.
It was great to see them in that way. So rock and roll has taken a bit of a shit kicking. So it's, I don't go out to a lot of shows. So it was really kind of invigorating to see them.
Yeah, Victory Lap is a great album, too. I don't know if you've caught much of that, but it's a really good album. Yeah. Last two albums they've done, they've recorded in Winnipeg with, I think, the same guy. And they're such well-recorded records. Like, they just do it. I mean, like, I remember watching them at the Alma Combo, and it was one of the first times they came to Toronto, I think, or it would have been maybe the first or second time. But it was on Let's Talk More Rock, so it would have been the second, first or second time. And they just didn't seem to take anything serious. And I thought, oh, okay. You know, and actually Chris even said with his own shorts over his head going, we fucking suck. Like telling the audience that they suck. Yeah. And I think they realized one day like, oh, this is a band. We're a business. Like we need to, people buy our records. We need to be the best we possibly can be. So they practice like a job. Like they, you know, they go in and rehearse like a real job and then come home, and they got so good. Like in between, what was Let's Talk More Rock? What was the one after that?
I can't. Is that Potemkin or I don't know.
Whatever. But it, between these two records, it became like, oh, a different night and day band. You know, like where they could pull off live what they were doing in the studio. But
Well, even in their business, and I like when bands, you know, it's great when bands can pump out great records all the time.
Yeah.
But it's not really a reality. So I like when bands take 3 or 4 years and they don't put band like a album out all the time, and then all of a sudden they're back, and you know, it just took some time to, you know, whatever they need to do, collect yourself.
Yeah. Well, so. And they're not in a hurry. I mean, yeah, and you know, I actually had Chris on the show a couple of years ago, and it was interesting talking to him about being a dad and like life and, you know, and now, I mean, this sort of thing about what happens as you get older is you start forgetting, like, you know, I love music, but I also love the stability, and I love a home, and I love a home life. And these are all the things that not a lot of people get to sort of, you know, witness or understand, or, you know what I mean? Or live. And even if it's like
part of our demographic right now though, but you know, we have gone through those, you know, and God love them, we've gone through those times where we've been on tour and we've gone to the top and bottom of the experience. And that's what's great to see you from kind of afar, is to see how, you know, that you've turned into a, you know, a great tech, and you're out with it. Like to be out on the road with SNFU and experience that. You know, and to come back and to, you know, I was just listening to you and Mark Belkey's interview a little bit before we talked. I don't like to live in the past, but there is definitely an anchor there, right?
It's who you are. Like, there's always little bits of who you are now that who you were. And for the better part, if you find yourself in a successful, if you've made a successful go at it, the bad parts get left behind and the good parts stay and get more embellished. So if you're kind of inherent, if people are inherently mean people, then maybe once they get older, they won't be as mean, you know. And when nice people are kind of cool people, they don't generally turn into assholes. You know what I mean? They always kind of stay nice people, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and the people that we've met, the people that we can still relate to, even all these years have gone by, we still have a common thread that to look back as that's who we were in the anchor. It's a very important thing in life, but it's also good to let the bad stuff go and not be that 21-year-old again. Cause
yes,
you know, who wants that, you know, all that.
Confusion. No, definitely. Yeah. And we're talking about too, it's like, we want to be at times there's a feeling of comfort, just kind of being a homebody. Mm-hmm. And I find it difficult, and I have no kids. I have a wonderful girlfriend, and we have a dog. But we, you know, my ambition to play music was waning for quite a while, and I picked up an acoustic guitar, and I did like 4 or 5 shows over the last couple of years, just like solo stuff, doing covers. And I was just like going, wow, I didn't really know how to define to myself what I wanted to do with that. Like, do I want to relive the past, or do I want to, you know, start over and start new and start a music career? So
I think as we get older, the understanding of what success in music is isn't always about money anymore. It's not about record sales. It's about what makes you happy. Because what makes you happy as a musician only reflects to what you put out as a musician, right? So if you're cranky and angry and upset and sort of skeptical about the music business, you're going to write music that is cranky, skeptical about the music business. You know what I mean? Like, it's tough. It's tough to be honest it's tough to sort of paint a pretty picture on things, because we both know the music business has changed over the past 15 or 16 years, or even the past 20 years since I've been involved with it, really, that it's a tough game to play. And do you want to play that game? Not a lot of people do, you know? I mean, to quote Mark Belky, we were talking about, like, why bother?
You know what I mean? No, for sure. And that's the thing. And there are experiences to have too. And just sitting with my friends and playing guitar is like, I get the same kind of, you know, feeling. Mm-hmm. There were those times though, like at, and it isn't about reliving it, but I'd never felt such energy playing in front of 1,000 people, and there's a giant pit, mm-hmm. and you know, your veins are just popping. Yeah. And you wrote, and the thing was, it was so, you know, we wrote the songs, we bought the van, we booked the shows, and then we saved the money to go out and make $100 or a couple of $100. And then when it actually happened, you know, it was such a victory, mm-hmm. that, those tangible victories, it's almost like, you know, in a weird way, like mowing the lawn. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's so many victories on the internet and digitally. Just seeing, like, you have tall grass and you just mauled all down.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or you build something, right?
Yeah.
Or you build a shed or something. Those tangible things and having that victory.
Yeah. Creating something from nothing.
On a visceral kind of sense. I don't want to get too philosophical about it, but that's what I guess I'm getting at, is that, you know, that's something that I think is vital.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, there's the idea. I mean, I can imagine people, like, you can attribute it to guys who build furniture from nothing, or, you know, they take a piece of a log and they make it into planks, and then from there they turn into something, like, based on what their vision is. And that's essentially music. Like, you know, you think you've put something out of your head into an instrument, onto tape. You've made it into this record, people buy it and love it. And it's like, the connection that you've created is based on something that was just in your brain, you know what I mean? Or it was a thought, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the difference between then and now is that people think it's easy to do stuff like that, because there's so many crutches along the way for you to plug in your guitar into GarageBand or whatever and have a drum beat and make a song. I mean, it's turned into this new way of doing things where it's all the hard stuff's done for you, except becoming except for becoming famous. It's still hard.
Yeah. No, that was a good addition to that idea too, because it's like information is moving so fast too, and you can put shit together really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like as far as just putting a song together and throwing it out there. The technology is now in our hands, and you pay $400 an hour to go into a place that with 2-inch tape and an engineer, and then you pay for a producer, right?
Yep.
Sorry, Simon, those days are over.
I know. No, hey man, it's funny you say that, because
I'm sure you get lots of work.
No, it's where I came into it right at the end of analog. Like I was sort of on that very beginning of digital, where I had ADAT machines. I don't remember if you remember this, but I used to travel all over Canada with all that shit in the back of my van.
With your van? I do remember your mobile recording machine.
Yeah. And I used to just, I spent a month in Calgary at one point. And I was
You texted me, and I never, like, it's the thing, I was never that proactive about, you know, when I was into it, like Field Day and before that, you know, be more proactive into just like, oh, I have a chance to record. And I just, it's, that ambition has kind of lost me somewhat, but, you know, I spend more time, playing keyboards, with my headphones on and, working out, song patterns that way.
Yeah. Well, it makes you happy. That's all that matters. I mean, is there ever a chance of putting Field Day? Have you done any reunion stuff with Field Day, or with, you know?
No, the last show we did was at the CJSW 25th anniversary show at Mac Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And Wagbeard reunited. And who else was there? And Primrods. And there was like bands from all through it. And there was like five different rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually were a five piece that night. We had got an extra guitar player and keys.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so it was fun. But no, Jay and I had talked that we kind of want to just let it go. And I've wanted to just put it to rest too. I enjoyed the time. And I have an anchor in the past, but I feel I don't want to go back to that well too much.
No, we all know that one guy that hangs out in the punk club who's still that same person that they were 30 years ago. And that's not always a good thing. It's not always a good thing. You know, generally that person's life isn't doing so awesome. If that one punk guy in the club, you know, at the back of the club, it's, you're right. You have to sort of look forward and sort of take the good stuff. Like I've always just taken the good stuff out of it and forgotten the bad stuff. And I've tried to anyways, and tried to, and I don't want to romanticize with it, but at the same time, it changed who I was fundamentally, you know, from being in punk rock and touring and DIY bands. And I want to say it enriched my life. Like had I not met certain people at a certain time in my life, I probably wouldn't be the person I am now, you know? And I like,
I agree. I love that the community that we did have, you know, you'd have a Big Drill Car coming through, or Furnace Face.
Yeah.
You know, it could be from east to west, or, you know, there was such community, and you could come sit on my couch and trading phone numbers. And we were all for one, right?
Yeah. And definitely was. And it was just before sort of corporate rock kind of took over punk rock, you know, just before, you know, Nirvana and Green Day, I guess later on, and Offspring and all that stuff. Like,
how did you feel about, because we were talking about, because it was a struggle, and I'm sure a lot of, you know, like guys and women that have grown up before that time kind of going, well, you know, we kind of got persecuted for it, and we got kicked around and called goofs and picked on. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it breaks out and it's cool. Like, what were your first kind of thoughts of how that broke out?
I only thought that if I knew the people that were becoming famous over it, then I didn't really have a problem with it. But what I did, my only real observation to the whole thing is we were in Chicago during the second Woodstock, I guess the 90s Woodstock. and we were watching Green. I was at Jughead's house from Screeching Weasel, and we were staying at his apartment, and he was watching the live feed of Woodstock, and he was watching Green Day play, and he was standing in front of the TV watching this go down, and I'm like looking at him, and he's just like kind of shaking his head. I go, what do you think of all that? And he's like, I don't know what to think, man. I don't know what to think. Because, you know what I mean? Like, it's interesting. Like, you're just
and
sitting
you
there.
Go, this is going to be, when we heard Dookie, we're just like, Jay and I were in the van. We were on tour somewhere, and we put Dookie, and we just go, oh, fuck.
Yeah, totally.
And plus, we were Field Day before, like, Green Day blew up, and then, so we knew we were going to get fucking.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, you're like them. Like, well, Field is, like, green, and.
See, I never now until now put that together. That's how stupid I am.
Thank you, Simon.
I know. No, I never would have drawn that.
Because you're not a superficial person. It's funny. I realized that because I'm actually wearing bifocals now. Yeah. So I've been looking down at you like this.
Yeah, it's true.
This is how I usually look, but I'm wearing bifocals now.
There you go.
So.
Yeah. You see, yeah, actually, for me, when it came to like corporate, punk rock goes corporate. I only sort of thought it was like a benefit, you know what I mean? That means sort of like, well, if, you know, Nirvana, Green Day, they obviously have good people behind them, but it's possible, you know what I mean? Like anything's possible now. And sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say there's almost like maybe a pretentiousness on, and I'll include you, on our levels that, well, then they don't deserve it because it's just going to be commercialized and there's going to be, you know, Offspring and they're going to go way oh, but I love the fact that Offspring, you know, their songs were good,
yeah, of course.
And I liked that it got big, but then I was still just like, well, what? And I don't really care if someone has an experience with another piece of music or whatever, it's not really something that I invest in. But I do think about the actualities of like, well, you know, I guess it's the progress of music.
Yeah.
You know.
You want it to be yours.
It's Rage Against the Machine, right?
Yeah.
And it becomes popular.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally.
So fuck you. I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, and it becomes popular. So.
I tell you one time I did feel, I'm not jealousy, but a little bit of anger is when the Weaker Thans broke out. Cause like I used to watch them at the Shanghai,
I get that too.
12 people, and then they sold out Lee's Palace, which to me was a big show. And I remember being there and being like so weirded out, going like, "Why do all these people like my favorite band? Why are all these people here?
This is my thing.
This is my band. Yeah, why are you here? You know. Because the other thing behind that is that when they first mixed Fallow, they stayed in my apartment. And they almost got me and my now wife kicked out of our apartment because they were sleeping on our couch and we gave them a key. And so they'd go mix their record at phase one and then come back and stay at our apartment. So the landlord below thought we had extra people living in the apartment. So they actually locked the doors on us saying, you can't have other people living here. Like they're just visiting like for 5 days. They couldn't believe like we had friends staying for mixing the record for 5 days. So for me, I'm like, well, I just got kicked out of an apartment for the Weaker Thans. And so it was John, Jason and Steve hadn't even joined the band yet. And then they occasionally would come back, you know, and stay in our house and stuff. But I remember feeling some anger, like being at a big old venue and going, okay. Well,
it is kind of just, I think, a bit of an insecurity and a sacredness of, it's like someone going through your sacred box, right?
Yeah.
This is my stuff. And then all of a sudden, and this is, I've thought about these songs and I've romanticized these songs and me and my friends have all been involved in these songs and this thing. And then all of a sudden, all you people are coming in and going, oh, look at all this stuff. And they're throwing it all around and they're getting drunk and they don't know what it means. And like, well, they can have their own meaning. Yeah. I'm going like...
Yeah.
I'm going, oh, this is terrible. Oh.
Yeah. I think what changed my mind is when I had my band Foursquare, we went and opened for the Weaker Thans in Europe. And when they would play equally as big as shows in Europe during Left and Leaving. Was it Left and Leaving or the one after Left and Leaving? But seeing all the people getting into the Weaker Thans from Europe, it didn't seem like such a bad thing. You know what I mean? Because the A part was because they were there early and they'd come and see our band, and we were Canadian. They liked us because we were Canadian, so we had a bit of an advantage. But then watching the Weaker Thans, sort of watching John Sampson like wow people that don't speak English very good, and I thought that's a very, very powerful tool.
Mm-hmm.
The words you've chosen are universal to people who speak a little bit of English, and people have a very good knowledge of the English language, and that's always been a strong point. I've been working with Lois Low and Greg Smith, who was in the Weaker Thans, is now in Lois Low, and we had this long conversation about John Sampson, and I said, you know, it's a shame that he doesn't go and play much anymore, because there's so many, like, even Weaker Thans, like, well, you know, and this and that. So I had this, my point was, he's not being very nice to the people like his band. You know, he should go out and play more, you know, whether he wants to.
Actually,
he should go do
that. You're right,
he's a total recluse.
You're right. No, I agree, he does. I think the melodies and the simple yet relevant topics in their music, especially Left and Leaving for me too, and it's like one of the more popular ones, and why I'm justifying that, but no, it is a delivery that is, and I've experienced, I'm the production manager for Calgary Folk Fest, and so we had them, I think, it was last year or the year before, on main stage, and just to see it all go down again, too, and you know, playing some of the solo stuff, but then going into some of my favorite songs, too.
Yeah.
And there are 10,000 people just, like, captivated.
Yeah.
It is, you know, I like... It, you know, that's the team, though, right? I think they're still part of the team. Right?
That's true. There's still a lot. They get a pass, but Green Day somehow didn't get the pass. But the when Weaker Thans, they played, where did they play? They played a show. They opened up for Lois Low and Billy Bragg at the Molson Amphitheater, which is like it's called the Budweiser stage now.
And this is recently?
Yeah, no, it was a couple of years ago now. It was when Lois Low got back together about 10 years ago. And they played, and they were relatively, I think it was still Left and Leaving days. And to me, it was like, I didn't realize they could play in front of that many people and sort of bring an audience in, even though it was sort of daylight still, and they were sort of playing, you know what I mean? But they still managed to sort of get people on board.
To create a moment, It's tough. It's tough in a festival atmosphere to create a kind of sentimental
magic
moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk. I mean, we should talk a little bit about what you do now, because working a festival, I mean, I've played a few of them, but it must be such sleepless nights worrying about making sure everything is together. What's your role in all of that?
I was production manager with Calgary Folk Fest, just overseeing pretty much sound, lights, artist schedules, and such, just making sure that hopefully everything looks good, sounds good, and is on time, and all the artists have what they need to make it happen. Outside of that, it's more important that we have like just an incredible group of people that work for the Calgary Folk Festival and 1,800 volunteers. And so I've been out on the road. I was very grateful to get this opportunity. I'd been a contractor for the festival as a site manager for a few years, and then Festival Hall was created, and it's a 225-seat concert hall that we have our offices in as well. So it offered the festival to give me a full-time job, and it got me off the road. So that was, I'd been on the road for a while and was looking for more of a kind of home-style job. And but still have the variety of not, you know, 9 to 5 and making grommets. So no, it's been great. And so we're gearing up right now for, we have Joe Jackson this year.
Oh,
so,
man, you know, I have a wedding to go to. Otherwise, I was going to.
Did I invite you out?
You did. I was going to come out, but I have a wedding to go to before I come back out to, because I'm going to be in Edmonton doing the, is it High Valley? Not High Valley. The one in
High Water, High Valley.
Not a High Valley. The one in Edmonton, Leduc, the Craven. I should know it because I'm tour managing it. I forget what it's called. It's a, well, it's a country festival.
Because they're fellow festivals.
Yeah, it's a country festival. And it's sort of the weekend of the 16th, I think. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I was going to come there with my son and then send him home on the plane and then just take a rental car up to Edmonton and meet the... Because it was literally like it's one ends and the other one starts. But I have a wedding to go to, so I can't do both. But next year, I want to take you up on the offer because...
Yeah, it's our 40th anniversary for Calgary Folk Fest next year.
Oh, that'll be a good time. So the question I had was, it must be like crazy to like finish the festival and then immediately have to jump into 2019. Like, because that must, you take some time off, you must take some time off, but knowing that you have to start the whole circle again, is it daunting? Is it scary? Is it just get better at it?
No, it is, it gets a little bit daunting, a little bit scary, but it's manageable in that the folks that I work with and I say the infrastructure we have behind us and also the commitment and ownership that volunteers and staff take of our organization, it takes a lot of that edge off.
Yeah.
So, but we are, especially, you know, we do start, we're booking, we do a block heater, which is a kind of our winter festival, and we do it in three or four different venues downtown Calgary near our concert halls in Inglewood. Mm-hmm. So we have like four or five different venues. So we do kind of a halfway through the year, we do a winter festival, and we're in our fourth year with that. So yeah, we just, you know, we keep
constant loop.
I will take some time off. I'm actually taking a little bit of extra time, and Lucy and Tasha and I are driving down the Pacific Coast Highway, starting in August. So
where are you going to start from? Like up that the north end of America, or are you?
Going to start. Our first stop is kind of Denny Creek. It's just right by Seattle, and then we go Penrose and Cannon Beach, and then we're going down the Pacific Coast for like quite a few weeks. So
amazing. That sounds like super good time. And you've taken road trips before, but it's so funny taking road trips now where you don't really need to be anywhere. Like you don't have to you don't have to drive through the nice part of town to be in the shitty part of town to do a show. It's like, oh, let's go. We have no, but you know what I mean? We took our kids down to Florida and I've done that drive down the I-75 a few times, 100 times. And it was like, oh yeah. I remember stopping here. I remember stopping there, but I'm just driving through and my kids have are totally oblivious of all the crazy shitholes I've been to along the way. And, and so we get down to Florida, we sit on a beach and we're like, hey, this is all right. I'll take that.
No, totally. We have been through those cities like one or two nights, and maybe you got a couple of days off. So
yeah,
I've always had this trip. Yeah, I've always, since I was a kid, kind of wanted to do this drive. So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, that's cool, man. Well, I really, you know, we kind of missed the whole field day trip and things like that. But I, you know, when you said I don't really want to live in the past, I'm with you, man.
It was fun. I got to say that I love Jay Creeway. Like, he's been my best friend for a long time. And Jonas, what an individual. Like, Jay and I were playing together, and I know how well you knew Jonas.
A little bit.
Yeah, but a strong, talented kid that just really, he was kind of the nitro fuel that made that band happen, I think. So
yeah. Where's he living now?
He's up in the Yukon.
You know, someone told me that.
Yeah, he's been up there for quite a while.
Yeah.
He did have the JJS3, which he was banned, and they came down to Calgary. It was like 4 or 5 years ago and they opened for COC.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he had open heart surgery as a young man too. And so that was the last time we saw him he just bailed. Like, such an individual. He reminds me of Doug Bevins from the Smalls.
Oh yeah.
That they just walk to their own walk and it's conviction. So
no, he's good. It was fun. Yeah. Cause it was like, I didn't, I think I was close with him for a little bit and then close with you for a little bit. But when I was, because, yeah, I can't remember how that dynamic worked out in Edmonton, or sorry, in Calgary. But yeah, he was definitely his own person. I remember there's one song, he's like talking about somebody, like, and he points at me and he's like yelling at something and yelling. It was in Montreal. I'm like, why is he pointing at me and yelling? I couldn't get the lyrics because it was just a weird.
I was like, oh, that's funny that you had that memory pocketed in your brain.
Yeah, right? I thought he was mad at me. Yeah, he had a fuck word in there too. Fucking. And I was like, okay. Okay.
You might have fucked him over sometimes.
Maybe I did. I don't know.
No, that night was so hot. If you listened to our first album, Friction, at the end, we have that long kind of thing where it's just got. I don't know if you've heard it, but it just has like audio from video that we took from tours. And it just, yeah, it's just got like, and it's at that show in Montreal.
Yeah.
And we're talking to this guy out in front of the Purple Haze, and he's talking French. He's like, oh, he's super drunk. So like, oh, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. And the alarm's going, boop, 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 boop. We don't even notice it. It was Tom Tana or Rhodey was inside, and they had locked the doors and set the alarm. He's inside, and he's trying to get out. The alarm's going off, and we're out like doing this video.
I remember that show. I remember something from that show. We were like, we got to keep the door. Like the two bands, we split the door. But what we didn't know at the end of the night is that from the door, we had to pay the bouncer.
Right.
So there was like $110 taken at the door, and the bouncer was like $50. And we're like, oh, okay.
We should have got a contract. So.
It's like, oh, all right. So the bouncer made as much as both bands put together, and there was no problems. Well, can we take some money from him? Because we all need money and gas and stuff. That's
I still think I have the poster for that show too, because I took it from this like sideshow. Book and had this guy's bulging eyes out, like this Afro-American guy and his eyes bulging out. And they had made, like, you know, when you, like, we would make 8.5 by 11 or 11 by 17 posters where we were from.
Yeah.
You go to Montreal and they're fucking giant posters, you know, 3 feet by 2 feet. Yep. So I think I still have it rolled up somewhere.
Did you guys used to stay with Paget in Montreal?
Yeah. I just talked to Paget.
Oh, wow.
We're talking about Steve Soto.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. What a drag. Couldn't have happened to a nicer man.
I know, eh?
54. How old are you?
I know. I'm 53.
Jesus. Yeah.
I know. Well, my brother just passed. He was 56.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah.
But no, we're in that zone. I'm the last of the Heebs.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Oh man!
No, I got my. I know this is like poor guy. No,
oh dear!
I have my community, and you know, no, it's been, that's one thing that I feel about you know punk rock and all that, because you know there was people that were just drunken assholes, and I didn't really dig the Sex Pistols. I liked the music, but it was more the Minor Threats and the Bad Religions and. You know, even the G.G. Allens and Meat Men and stuff like that. But it was those bands that said, like, you know, it's, if you feel marginalized and broken and you don't feel you have a friend, come on over here. Come on over here.
Yeah, we'll take you.
And we're not going to give you easy answers. we're going to talk about what the fuck's going on.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a breath, that's what I take from all that.
Well, that's a good way to end off.
All right, man.
Thanks, buddy.
Ted.
And that was John Hebert of now the Calgary Folk Fest. Before then, guitar player, lead singer of the band Field Day. Before then, 15-year-old punk rocker who used to play shows and open up for big, queer, easy bands like DOA. I can't explain this. But what I do know is that someone who's put their whole life into something, for some reason, they have such a great and interesting look at what it was back then, what it looked like, and what their perception of it was. And what usually happens is that all the crappy, shitty parts go away. And you do remember the good. But when you remember the bad stuff is amplified times a thousandfold. That's a word. Times a thousand. And we really need to sort of understand that when you, like you say, you put your heart and your soul into music or into art or into something that is supposed to create a stir or an awareness in people, you have to understand that the payoff isn't just about money. It's not just about being famous. It satisfies something very deep in yourself. And I'm only really speaking from what I hear. And I do understand, like when people like John speak, is that they don't want to live in the past. Neither do I, really. But it's who we are. He said it before, like we're an anchor. That's an anchor. That's what who you grow up to be is hopefully good parts of that. And that is the end of the show. So that's my little rant. And I'm trying, I don't want to make this a thing, but my observation on this episode was that, you know, somebody who's lived in punk rock and lived with some sort of like, usually punk rock and it's not popular music, so therefore you don't really get like monetary feedback. You don't get money and you don't get the fame and regard, but you do get those little treasures that you've left behind. And like I said, that was a very important episode for me to speak with John and understand that, you know, he's a good person and he came out the other end doing okay. All right. So that's it. That's all I got to say about that. And I will try not to make this sort of a soapbox ending. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the show. Don't forget to go to betterhelp.com/apolog. Don't forget to go shopping on Amazon by going to apolog.ca/Amazon or apolog.ca/US Amazon. Yeah. I want to thank everybody for... this is 190th show, by the way. So I forgot to mention that. But that 190 shows is a lot of talking. And for me, it's a bit of an accomplishment. And I said I would do it 100 at a time. And I'm going to do another 10 more. And then we'll see how it goes. We'll see how everything sits. And right now, it's great. I got to tell you, though, with my new job and how things go, it gets a little tough trying to put these things together. So anybody who wants to be a guest host on this thing, let me know. I'll set you up. You can be on the show. You can be the host. You know, put episodes out. Take the summer. Take a week. Get weird. See you next week, everybody. I got a great, 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 great guest next week. Very, very happy to say. Okay, so you're gonna have to wait.